From climate change to energy and environmental matters, you're listening to Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to Unleashed with Mark Morano, continuing our program. All right. We had a great conversation with Myron Ebell the last hour. That was phenomenal. I would like to have him back on. But he was giving us a evolution of Washington, D.C. and how things have changed since at least the Clinton administration. Interestingly enough, Tucker Carlson, about a month ago, said he'd like to return to the America of 1993. He considered that like one of the peak years of America. And that was a time of debate, free speech. We were still on the bad path in many different ways in terms of government, central planning, massive expansion of government spending. If you recall, that's when Hillary Clinton proposed her healthcare, national healthcare, but of course it failed at the time, not to be resurrected until President Obama many decades later, decade and a half later. And that was the time of doing it. Well, the Democrats now are so radical that Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman has now emerged as the voice of reason for the Democrats. John Fetterman, again, if I know there's a lot of conspiracy theories and whether this is really him, but I am amazed. This guy seemed completely out of it, debilitated by a stroke. He didn't seem with it mentally. And then he sort of disappeared for a while. He went in, checked in for the mental health issue, and then sort of laid low. And then he reappears with a mustache, and he seems sharp, seems somewhat witty. He seems with it. He seems like he truly recovered from his stroke. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know what happened. But he's no longer the laughingstock joke of a senator, you know, who can't even talk conversation. I'm not sure if he still has the audio processing issue, but he can actually speak and do interviews now, which is amazing. Anyway, he's now emerged as the voice of reason for the Democrats. And this guy was considered very radical. So let's watch clip one, John Fetterman, Pennsylvania senator.
But it is not appropriate or legal, or it's helpful to advance your argument if you show up in a Starbucks with a bullhorn and start yelling at people, and that doesn't make you noble. It just makes you an asshole.
He's talking about all the essentially the climate activists and the radicals, and he doesn't like it. And he's really rehabilitating. He's reworking his whole image as a somewhat mainstream, maybe conservative Democrat from Pennsylvania. Now, a lot of that's electoral politics of Pennsylvania, perhaps. And a lot of that, maybe he's just changing. I'm not sure. But he's now criticizing that he's not the radical that they thought they were getting in. The AOC, which even AOC really isn't a radical. She will go along with the establishment at every turn when she needs to, when she's only a radical when it doesn't matter, in other words. And that's the way Washington works. But typically, the longer you stay in office, the more liberal you become. And that happens to everyone, both parties, particularly conservative Republicans. And again, we talked yesterday about the Speaker of the House, Johnson, and just what a disappointment he is. He's just doing the bidding of the establishment, just nothing interesting, or he may as well have Kevin McCarthy. The whole thing was a charade, a waste of our time to switch speakers because we basically got Kevin McCarthy with this new speaker. All right. Steve Malloy, friend of the show who was on from junkscience.com, did a great hit on this, on Newsmax, but it's just a great summary of what Earth Day has become. This is the 55th Earth Day we just passed, founded in 1970. And this is Steve Malloy summing up what really is happening with Earth Day, clip two.
Look, this is our 55th Earth Day, and we've gotten to the point where environmentalists are the actual environmental problem. Their policies have turned our forests into tinderboxes. Mm-hmm. Their policies are destroying our oceans and open lands and forests with wind turbines and solar panels. And then we have less sexy problems, but which are actually very important, like stormwater runoff. There's no money for that. So we have all these pollutants from, you know, urban areas just being dumped into our waterways. And because we're all focused on climate, we can't do anything about any of these other things.
So well said. Two great points. Steve Malloy and Diana Furscott-Roth, thank you both.
And as very well said. And by the way, Diana Friscott-Roth will be on this program later this week. She's from the Heritage Foundation, their energy person. So what Stephen Loy said is exactly right. It's what we actually talked about with Myron Ebell the last hour. Climate change has hijacked the environmental movement, taken away and pushed to the side the real environmental concerns, toxic waste cleanup, the East Palestine train wreck where they had to spill of chemicals and they decided, hey, it's not just enough that we get it in the waterways and seep into the soil. Let's send it in the atmosphere and let's light it up. And, you know, mushroom cloud of toxic chemicals goes into the sky. He's exactly right, though. When you're focused, hyper-focused on this ridiculous, nebulous concept of climate change, the real actual environmental issues fall to the wayside. And by the way, it was a long time before the Biden administration reacted, and only under pressure to the poor residents of the Trump-voting East Palestine, Ohio, that train wreck, the train derailment that had happened. This was now, geez, I don't know when it was, over a year ago, I believe. So that's what the Earth Day is about. And also, friend of the show, Tom Harris, who was on the program last week, has a new column out at American Out Loud, and it's just really well done. It's time to cancel Earth Day. Tom Harris, the president of the International Climate Science Coalition. And here's what he writes. Monday was the 55th anniversary of Earth Day, which used to be focused on actually protecting our home planet. As I mentioned, the 1970 Earth Day brought out the middle class, brought out the masses. People were sick of particularly urban areas, the filthy rivers, the filthy air. And we've made such radical improvements since the first Earth Day, 1970. It's the environmental success story. We have among the cleanest air in the world, according to the World Health Organization, the United States. So what he says here is on Earth Day, he says, the past few days, Earth Days, we need to cancel the whole idea of Earth Day. It's done. And then he has some other interviews. He has Sterling Burnett, who's been on this program at the Heartland Institute. He says, Earth Day has become virtually meaningless. What was once a day set aside to consider how human activities were impacting the Earth and how we could minimize damage is nothing more than a marketing ploy. Politically connected green special interests touting their subsidized technology as saving the Earth, all while ignoring hidden environmental damage inherent throughout the supply chains. Of course, green energy is not green. And then we also had James Taylor, the president of Heartland. Earth Day should remind us that collectivist governments and nations have always been the worst stewards of our environment. Today's Earth climate change frenzy illustrates this. Traditional environmental values like conservation and species protection are getting sacrificed on the altar of the collectivist climate belief system. Well said, James Taylor. And of course, I just did an interview recently with American Family News on Earth Day and just pointed out very similar things, that the wealthiest, most prosperous societies have the cleanest environments. The poorest, most centrally planned socialist economies have the worst environments. It's just that simple. The wealthier you are, the cleaner your environment. We should be pushing wealth, which leads to technology, prosperity. You have time to worry about things like a clean environment. When you're stuck in subsistence level living, you don't care about the environment. You're slashing and burning, dumping waste. You're burning dung in your hut. You're breathing in horrible air quality. Right. And I was talking in the last hour about everything's changed, this wackiness, the corporate culture, whether it's transgender, critical race, climate, the whole net zero. Is this going to be the next big thing? This may be partially just a joke, but it's very plausible. You've heard of gender-affirming care? Well, this is species-affirming surgery. It may just be a joke, but it makes a very serious point. This is clip 3, species-affirming surgery. Let's take a look.
Species-affirming surgery, things that will not happen for 500, Alex. Bill Nye, the Science Guy's book.
I'm just wondering when there's going to be like more species-affirming surgeries. I got bottom surgery. It's great. Love it. Fantastic. Having a V is awesome. But like, how close are we to like when can I get a tail? When can I have my ears removed and pointed and put on the top of my head instead? When can I have fur all over my entire body? When can I have my skull restructured so that I have a snoot? What about like scales? Cause I'll settle for being a scaly. Could get my tongue split, like, could I be gooey? Could I get like paw pads? Could I have my legs bones like restructured to be like digigrade? What about like antlers? Like, come on, that's gotta be possible medically. How close are we to these things? Scientists, Hank Green.
So we have species-affirming surgery when becoming a woman isn't enough. These are the type of people who are invited to speak at the White House. Someone said, this is awesome. They should do it.
Yes, species-affirming surgery. There are stories. Oh, first of all, we've gone through the history of this. The Chinese foot binding on women because they thought women with big feet were unattractive. We've gone through the castration and the old opera houses in the 19th century where they would castrate the young boys to keep their voice a certain octave, I guess you could say. You have the female circumcision in Africa, which feminists have rightly decried. And now you have, of course, transgender surgery where they mutilate you, the top and bottom surgeries and the puberty blockers, it's frightening stuff. And now they're talking about species-affirming surgery. But it even goes beyond that. And I don't even like to show this kind of stuff, but there's actually interviews, mainstream, corporate media, people who want to be disabled, like they want to transition to a disabled person. And they intentionally pour toxic chemicals like bleach in their eyes to blind themselves so they can live the life of a blind person irreversibly. And they have psychiatrists who support this. They have a support staff who helps them blind themselves or people who cut off limbs. Why not have species-affirming surgery? If you identify as a giraffe or something, why not start getting surgery to make yourself look more animal-like? It's just, this is, the madness, the contagion of crowds, the madness of society. There's a book on this, The Madness of the Crowds. I don't know the title with me, but I've seen many presentations with excellent excerpts from this book. It's a book I have on my reading list that I have to get to actually read because it's from the 19th century and it lays out sort of how you get these mass social delusions that can sweep a nation. A more neutral example, a wholesome example would be the hula hoop craze in the 1950s in the United States. Became all these kind of crazes. That's fine. But then when it comes to things like the craze of transgenderism, that's irreversible and downright scary. Okay. This next clip is important. This is one of those iconic clips. This is after Bill Gates divested from the vaccines and their money was no longer to be made from them at this point, at this juncture. And he made this comment. I believe this was mid-2021, maybe early 2022. But he finally concedes that COVID had a low fatality rate, and it's a disease mainly of the elderly, kind of like the flu. Bill friggin' Gates admitting on video in an interview that COVID had a low mortality and was kind of like the flu. Where was he all this time? Every time on social media I did any comparison to a flu, I was immediately banned, canceled, labeled, misinformer. I was pounced on by the COVID mafia, the lockdown crowd. How dare you? It's not like the flu. It's not like the flu. Tons of anecdotal stories of people dying. This is clip 4. May want to play this twice. It's that significant. But let's watch this. Bill Gates conceding COVID, low fatality, like the flu.
People say not only China, were delayed telling people, but then was highly uncooperative in terms of any investigation.
They could have cooperated more than they did. There's attacks against them, like was it from the lab or was it intentional, that go way too far. And they have released a fair bit of data. And the case that it was in this wet market where you buy live animals of various types, I think the case for that is very, very strong. At that point, we didn't really understand the fatality rate. We didn't understand that it's a fairly low fatality rate and that it's a disease mainly of the elderly, kind of like flu is, although a bit different than that.
And there you have it. Bill Gates admitting COVID had a low fatality. We didn't know that at the time. Yes, we did know that at the time. I followed the Barrington Declaration. I followed the Michael Levitt, the Nobel Prize winning chemist. Remember his article in the Washington Post, maybe late March, early April 2020, talking about a very low fatality rate from COVID. In my book, The Great Reset, I quote none other than Klaus Schwab in June of 2020, talking about how low the fatality rate is at COVID compared to last things and how this we have it easy this time. Everyone knew that. But it's amazing to have Bill Gates admit it. I will be using that clip over and over. I'm gonna bookmark that one. It's a disease mainly of the elderly, kind of like the flu, fairly low fatality rate. Where the hell was that Bill Gates in March of 2020 when we needed him? Oh, we didn't know. We didn't know because we listened to Neil Ferguson's computer models in England just go would make up a bunch of bullshit and scare the hell out of the world. It was Chinese funded and serving the Chinese interests and the World Health Organization. Copy China if you want to know how to stop a virus. Nuts, just nuts. Okay, final clip. I love this. This is a MMA fighter, mixed martial arts fighter, in the streets of Florida. He's also a licensed Florida alligator trapper. His name is Mike Dragich. Uses his bare hands in a busy street to remove an eight-foot alligator from the city of Jacksonville, Florida. Watch this footage. It's great stuff. It's wild. Clip five. And that's how it's done. That was an old, almost Steve Irwin of the Crocodile Hunter fame. That's sort of how he would have done it. I love the way he pinned it down and then strapped its mouth. Because once you get the mouth done, they can still scratch you with their claws, but the deadly force is their mouth. It's the jaw action. I mean, it can actually dismember you pretty quickly. But anyway, I love that footage. Great way to segue into the break. When we come back, geologist Ian Plimer will be joining the program. I have not had him on. I had him on my old audio-only days on TNT. He will be joining Unleashed. He's Emeritus Professor of Earth Science at the University of Melbourne. We're going to ask him about the climate emergency. He's going to go through the latest data on climate change and the latest insanity of which the world is consumed. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We'll be back with geologist Ian Plimer when we return. Stay tuned.
TNT's Alex Zaharoff-Royt.
One of the things that AI lets you accomplish in your business and personal life in a faster and more efficient way on your desktop than you could before when you only had to do it through the cloud.
I think about what we do on a day-to-day basis, right? So as a salesperson, I'm creating emails to send out to customers to talk to them about how we'd love to do business with them, how we'd like to engage. And so one of the things that I've started to use is using AI to formulate, you know, emails and help start, instead of starting with a blank page. For me personally, I struggle with a blank page. I like to have something to build around. And so, you know, using a large language model has helped me be more efficient in my work life and create content and create things more quickly that I can then get out to market and work with my customers.
Talking Tech with Alex Zaharoff-Royt on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. Today's News Talk Radio.
Come on, let the man talk.
We never censor our hosts.
Good. Now, talk.
Uncensored news.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining the program now is Professor Ian Plimer, a geologist, Emeritus Professor of Earth Sciences at the University of Melbourne. He was Professor Head of the Earth Sciences after serving at the University of Newcastle. He has published more than 140 scientific papers. He's one of the editors of the 5 volumes Encyclopedia of Geology. Also the author of the book, 2023 book, The Little Green Book. And I believe that was different versions for different age groups. Also the author of the 2021 book, Green Murder. Love that title. A life sentence of net zero with no parole. Boy, love that subtitle. Welcome to the program, geologist Ian Professor. Ian Plimer.
You for having me, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming back. Yeah, we haven't talked to you in about a year and a half, but appreciate it. So We spoke together at the Heartland Institute in Florida last year at Orlando, and you gave a great talk on climate. So here we are now in 2024. We are told in the United States, Joe Biden, the situation is so dire, the mainstream media is reporting that he may declare a national climate emergency and invoke 130 wartime presidential powers by which to bypass democracy. Are we in a climate emergency, Professor Plimer?
No, we are certainly not. We are within normal variability of climate over hundreds, thousands, or millions of years. There is nothing special about today. All that President Biden wants to do is to take away your rights. He wants to take away your ability to think for yourself, to criticize, and to look at things from a different angle. So there is no climate emergency. And the last climate emergency we humans had was about 535 AD. And that's when we had a number of massive volcanoes erupt. That's when it became very cold. That's when we had starvation. That's when we had crop failure. That was a climate emergency. Since then, we have not had a climate emergency.
So let's walk this through. You're obviously in Australia and you're from Australia. What's the history of this? You know, if you go back to the 1970s, before they thought fossil fuels were driving a climate emergency, they thought fossil fuels were driving global cooling emergency. I mean, they were worried that the aerosols from fossil fuels were going to block out the sun and create global dimming. How has this debate evolved? And how did we go to this stage we're at now where they want to ban cars, restrict energy, collapse our food system, go after nitrogen, high yield agriculture, go after animal agriculture in the name of restricting methane? How did we get here? How did they get here scientifically? What are they claiming?
Well, there is no science to support this position. The only science that we have on climate change shows us that it regularly changes, that we have had a 50 million year period of cooling. We are still in that period of cooling, and that we are in an ice age. We've had ice at the poles for less than 20% of time. And we're in one of those periods of time when we've got ice at the poles. And when we have ice at the poles, it expands and it contracts. And these are the glaciations and interglacials. This whole story started a long time ago, and we've had thousands of years of people trying to frighten us, trying to tell us that the world is going to end, trying to tell us that we must pay up, we must support them. And we've had people entwining a little bit of mathematics or a little bit of science with these end of the world predictions. Now, if just one of these end of the world predictions was true, we wouldn't be here. So they've got it wrong every single time. And currently we have scare campaigns. These are run by the unelected elites. Their aim is to take away your rights, to take away your privileges, and to take away your freedoms. And to do that, we must start eating insects. We must reduce the population greatly. Now, these people are telling us to reduce the population. They should go first. They should say, okay, I'm going to lead by example, and I'm going to drop dead first. And I would say, well, of course, and I promise to follow you.
All right. Well, when you see like Al Gore's film, which I was just talking about last hour, some kids had to watch that movie four times in four different classes. One of the most compelling scenes is he gets up on an elevator and he shows CO2 levels. I think this was just based on the last maybe couple thousand years, showing CO2 levels off the charts that were at record levels of CO2. The Earth has never seen it this high. He couldn't even show you on the chart. They've gone off the roof and we've altered the atmosphere permanently and we're creating this climate crisis. Tell us, what did Al Gore mean by that chart, and are CO2 levels historically high and given Earth's history?
Well, he meant to frighten us. There's no other reason for it. He meant to frighten little children who are impressionable and who don't know anything else. We have, over geological time, we've had a number of major ice ages where we've had ice at sea level and at the equator. Now, in geological times, we've had up to 20% carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's currently 0.04%. And when we've had that very high carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we have had ice ages. So there's no relationship between ice ages there's no relationship between global warming and temperature. The past tells us that. So he was deliberately giving children misinformation to try to use it as propaganda to try to frighten them. Now, we are in a period of very low carbon dioxide. If the carbon dioxide content halved, we would have no plant life. And if we had no plant life, we would have no life on Earth. Carbon dioxide has gone up and down considerably. And just because we emit carbon dioxide and put it into the atmosphere, it doesn't mean it stays there. It actually is removed from the atmosphere very quickly by life, mainly by floating planktonic organisms. And once it's removed, then it is sequestered. Now, we've seen that for the last 500 million years. The planet's carbon dioxide content has been decreasing, and it continues to decrease. And there's quite a school of thought out there, which you'll never hear, but there's quite a school of thought out there saying, look, we're approaching a period of time when we could lose plants on planet Earth. Now, this has happened before. It's happened when we've had great ice ages, and we've dissolved a lot of carbon dioxide in the cold ocean waters, and the carbon dioxide has gone down to a level where plants struggle. So I think we probably do have a problem with carbon dioxide, and that is there's not enough of it. And if you love plants, don't try to hug them. If you love plants, burn fossil fuels to give them food.
Wow. All right. What about the United Nations in 1990, their first intergovernmental panel on climate change? Their report showed the medieval warm period was much warmer than current temperatures. And then we now know there was an academic campaign, UN scientists saying we had to get rid of the medieval warm period. Well, by 2001, they got rid of the medieval warm period. We had what's known as Michael Mann's hockey stick. And it showed temperatures flat for 1,000 years in the Northern Hemisphere, and then the 20th century spike. Shouldn't that scare people? Is that an accurate graph? Are we at unprecedented warmth for the last several thousand years right now?
Well, that scares me. It scares me that the scientific fraud is so easy to conduct. We've known from a blend of history and archaeology and science that we have temperatures that have risen and fallen during historical times. For example, during the times of Jesus, it was warmer than now. It was about 3 or 4 degrees Celsius warmer than now. Then we went into the Dark Ages, and this started with changes in solar activity and massive volcanic activity, and we had a couple of hundred years when it was much colder than now. Then we went into the medieval warm, and it was about 4 or 5 degrees warmer than now. And that went for 400 years. And in fact, it was such a warm time that in the Northern Hemisphere, 2 crops a year could be grown in summertime. The Northern Hemisphere became very wealthy. This wealth in Europe went into the great cathedrals and monasteries and universities. Then it cooled down, and it took 23 years to cool down from the medieval warming into the Little Ice Age. And we came out of the Little Ice Age about 180 years ago. And what do you expect would happen after you come out of a little ice age? Would it get cold or would it get warm? Well, it's become warm. So that, by the IPCC, was scientific fraud. That was supported by many of the scientists who are in the IPCC. And my view is that anything that comes out of the UN should be dismissed. And the UN, I think, has disgraced itself.
Yes. We actually had a scientist testify that a UN scientist emailed him and said, we have to get rid of the medieval warm period. And lo and behold, they got rid of it. It took about a decade, but they got rid of it. And that's where they, and with that hockey stick chart. When you look at the geologic history of the Earth, you said we were in the coldest, like 20%, I guess, where we had ice at either pole. Where are we in terms of temperature? You know, in terms of, are we in the 20% coldest period of Earth's history as well, in terms of the level of in terms of our current temperature? And is there any connection between carbon dioxide and temperature? Or is it a loose connection, or is there just no connection?
We are in one of the coldest periods that the planet's ever had. We are in the coldest 20% of the history of the planet. We are at a period of time when sea levels are relatively lower than they've been over geological time. And we see that when we look back in time, there is no relationship between carbon dioxide and temperature. What we see in laboratory studies is that for the first 100 parts per million carbon dioxide, it has an effect on atmospheric temperature, and after that, the effect is minimal. So we can show from ice core work, from looking back in the past, that there's no relationship. I'll give the example. Ice cores are a measurement of past temperatures and past conditions, and from those ice cores, you have chemical fingerprints where you can calculate what the temperature was. You have fingerprints of time, and this is ash from volcanic eruptions. So you can plot temperature over time. And we see the natural cycles of warming and cooling, depending upon whether we're close to the sun or far away from the sun. And this is driven by the orbits of the Earth. And this we've known for more than 100 years. We see that every time it warms, 1,000 or 2,000 years later, we get an increase in carbon dioxide. So it's actually temperature that's driving the atmospheric carbon dioxide content. It's not the inverse. And as we know from any soda or any beer or any drink that's got bubbles in it, that carbon dioxide has an inverse solubility. So if you've got a cup of coffee and you keep putting sugar into it, it will dissolve the hotter the coffee is. But with carbon dioxide, it will dissolve in water the colder the water is. So during glaciations, we can actually dissolve much more atmospheric carbon dioxide in seawater. And then when we warm up that seawater after the glaciation, there's a lag, and a couple of thousand years later, we get an increase in carbon dioxide. So we know that carbon dioxide doesn't drive temperature. It's the exact opposite.
Well, when you hear people like the U.S. climate envoy, John Kerry, say it's simple high school physics, and the New York Times will say more CO2 equals a warmer world. It's not high school physics, right? I mean, maybe it is, maybe it's that simple, but they have it exactly wrong. What about methane? People, they're coming after meat, whether it's in Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States. They're coming after animal agriculture because they're saying that cow emissions, animal agriculture, are worse than the planet warming gases from all the cars, planes, trains, and automobiles. Should we be eating meat, and how bad is methane for the climate? Is that a driver of climate change, global warming?
Well, methane oxidizes to carbon dioxide and water vapor very quickly in the atmosphere. It's a gas that many of us exhale. Every time you fart, you're releasing methane. We get methane released from any decomposing vegetation. We get methane that's in pockets of sediments in the ocean that get released. It is a common atmospheric gas. We've got some of the other planets that have got liquid methane on their surface. It's a common gas that is released from deep in the Earth. So that argument would only hold up if the US warmed up when it had roving bison along the plains. Now, most of these now have been wiped out. But you once had more bison in the US than you had cattle. You should have been warmer. You weren't. So it's wrong. It's demonstrably wrong.
All right, and then when you look at the extreme weather claims, one of the things you hear from the UN Secretary General, the UN Climate Chief, World Health, all the media, Joe Biden, your leaders, they always say, look at this. There's a record storm there. There's a record flood. There's a drought over here. Weather is not the same. This is extreme weather driven by carbon dioxide, driven by climate change. What do you say to that? Is the weather now acting weird and people want to rename it, to essentially wacky weather, and that we're driving this extreme dangerous weather? What's your scientific response to that?
Well, my response is that the weather between your ears is fairly turbulent and uncertain. That's what you're demonstrating, because when we look back in time, we see that the number of hurricanes hitting the U.S., has decreased. What has happened is that we have got wealthier, we've built better properties on the waterfront, and these properties become damaged, and the insurance bill is much higher. But we have a very good record of hurricanes that hit the shores in the US, and the number is decreasing. The damage is increasing, but the number's decreasing. Now, that is extreme weather, but we see these events have decreased. The same with wildfire. The sort of wildfires you get in the pine forests of California or our eucalyptus forests in Australia. The number of wildfires has actually decreased, but the maintenance of these forests is such that these fires can rage because the forests have not really been attended to. We've not had undergrowth clearing programs. We've not had backburning. So we've had much more intense fires in Australia in 1851 and 1939. So again, this is not extreme weather. This is extreme propaganda, because if we had a great bushfire in 1939, we would read about it in the newspaper maybe a week or maybe 2 weeks later. But now, as soon as there's a fire or a hurricane, we can have a camera there. We can have someone reporting, someone interviewing, crying mothers and screaming babies, and that goes instantly into our living rooms. So it looks as if we might have more extreme weather, but the facts give us a different story.
All right, we're talking with Professor Ian Plimer, geologist, emeritus professor of earth science at the University of Melbourne. We have to take a break. We're going to continue this. I want to talk about the policies that have come out of this, your two recent books. I love the title, Green Murder. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned. Ian Plimer will be right back with us when we come back.
When the world's endangered animals need help most, when their lives are at greatest risk, when they would otherwise be lost, the International Fund for Animal Welfare is there, taking action to rescue the animals we love, to protect them and their threatened natural habitats. But the danger to animals the world over is growing, and the need for your help has never been more urgent. On land, you'll help stop poachers from threatening and killing elephants and big cats for the illegal wildlife trade. In the oceans, you'll help rescue dolphins, whales, and seals from deadly hazards. And you'll help rescue, rehabilitate, and release vulnerable animals when disasters strike. Here at home and around the world, we can't do this work without you. See how you can help animals and people thrive together at joinifall.org.
She used to dance and dream of a better life, a brighter future. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, she dances for the world. Together, we give children in poverty a chance to set their sights high and achieve their dreams. Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today.
Fearless, informative, and unfettered. Mark Morano is Unleashed on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, we're continuing our discussion with geologist Dr. Ian Plimer. And obviously, globally, we're experiencing this, but in the U.S., any professors who speak out against this climate narrative and dissent, as you are doing, face all sorts of problems, whether it's Dr. Judith Curry, the climatologist, who basically left academia because she was disgusted by all of this. We have news anchors here in the United States that say, I won't interview a climate denier for the same reason I won't interview a Holocaust denier. How much cancel culture, intimidation, and censoring have you experienced trying to get your message out that there is no climate crisis?
Well, I put out a book called Heaven and Earth when I was at the University of Adelaide. That was an international bestseller. That book created enormous problems for me when I was at the University of Adelaide, and I left some 3 or 4 years later, but I was intending to leave anyway. I had better offers, and I was getting towards a stage where I was just sick of all the administrative bullshit that I had to go through to run a department. And I was more interested in teaching. I was more interested in getting young minds to work things out for themselves, to think. So the pressure in this country has been no different from that in the US and no different from anywhere else. And for interviewers not to interview someone with a contrary view is showing their ignorance. It's also showing exactly what this issue is. It's not a scientific issue. It's an issue of propaganda. It's got nothing to do with science. If it had something to do with the environment, we wouldn't destroy good farmland with wind turbines and solar panels. If it had something to do with the environment, we wouldn't be slicing and dicing eagles and seabirds. We wouldn't be putting up things like wind turbines to generate electricity. We would go back to the methods which we've taken thousands of years to develop, which have been very efficient, and now we're getting rid of these and rewiring grids right across many countries. So, unfortunately, we have a lot of interviewers who have no scientific training at all, who have taken a political position on this issue, and are unable to use common sense, because as we all know, common sense is not common.
That's great. Well, your most recent book, 2023, is called The Little Green Book, and it looks like you have multiple versions, some for 20s and wrinkles, for ankle biters. Tell us, what is The Little Green Book, and why did you make multiple versions of it?
I had many people say to me that we need a book for children. And my biggest pressure came from my daughter. So I sat down and wrote these three books for kids. Now, the first one is for children who are 6 to 12 years old. And that book focuses on how the human body works, how we eat food. We convert the carbon compounds into carbon dioxide. We're breathing in 0.04%. I don't use these figures, not for children. And we're breathing out about 4%. And I just point out that we breathe out so much carbon dioxide that if it was poisonous, then the best way to kill an old aunt who you don't like is to give her a big kiss, because she would be bathed in your carbon dioxide, and therefore it's obviously not lethal. I go into how your body converts food into methane, and so I've got quite a section on farting. Now, kids roll around with laughter when you talk about farting. And at the time I wrote it, I had a 7-year-old grandchild, he's a bit older now, in Montreal. And he was the person I was thinking of. The second book is for those who are 12 to 16. And these are for the kids who are at school, who may well have met activist teachers. And I just looked at some of the common examples that we spoke about before, how things like wildfires, hurricanes, they're not more prevalent now than they were in the past. Looking at sea level changes, written in a language for children of that age, and written dealing with people who would open the fridge and say, oh, there's nothing to eat. Or typical teenagers saying, oh, it's not fair. Well, I asked moral questions like, is it fair that you drive in an electric vehicle with the cobalt that has been mined by children your age in the Congo, run by Chinese companies, and these children are slaves? Is it fair that you can strut around feeling morally superior with some of your commodities given to the world by slave labour? I talk about the history of food over a long period of time, how we are living in the very, very best times ever to be a human on planet Earth. And the third book, which is written for kids who are 16 years and beyond, this is when they're getting influenced by teachers at college, when they might be in a work environment where they've got to be woke. And this is just giving them some basic facts. These are the facts which are well known in the literature, how we've got cycles of climate. And these cycles of climate are related to the pulling apart and stitching back of the continents every 400 or so million years. These cycles of climate are related to where we sit in the galaxy, and the galactic position every 143 million years is quite significant in driving ice on planet Earth. Some of the cycles are driven by our orbit, which is on 100,000-year cycles, where we get 100,000 years of cold and 100,000 years cycles where we've got 90,000 years of cold and 10,000 years of warm. And some of these cycles are 43,000 years, and some of them a little bit less on 20,000-year cycles. So I look at the orbital-driven cycles, and then I look at other things we don't hear much about, and that is cycles of the sun. Now, the sun puts out more energy at times, other times it puts out less energy. Sometimes we have a lunar tidal mode where we push warm water into the Arctic. And I say to the kids, well, look at when we had exploration through the Northwest Passage. That's every time we've had warm water pushed into the Arctic. So this is a compendium of facts for children to look at, maybe think, maybe change their mind, but use it as ammunition for arguments that they will undoubtedly get into at college and undoubtedly get into in their workplace. Now, if you use these sort of arguments at college, then you are going to fail, because our college system is training young people to tell lies, to write things that they know are not true. And so all I'm trying to do is to give parents and younger people ammunition to fight the propaganda they deal with in their everyday life.
All right, we're talking with Ian Plimer, the author of The Little Green Book, for all ages, a series of books he did explaining the climate change in an accurate term to them. You were also author of the book Green Murder, which I love, a life sentence of net zero with no parole. That was 2021. Tell us about Green Murder. How is net zero a life sentence with no parole?
Well, that book, I'm pretty savage with the Green Movement. I've been sick of being polite to them. And I go into the history of human development and how we are living in the best time ever to be there, and how many of these green policies, like electric vehicles, like rewiring countries into wind and solar, all of which we're seeing are failing now. We're seeing net zero in Europe fail. We've certainly seen it fail in the UK. How these policies are making people poorer. They're making their energy more expensive. They are restricting your freedoms, such as travel. They are restricting your diet. Now, I like to get my teeth around a good steak. Occasionally, I will have a bit of insect protein. And if I'm in the outback in the desert, quite often you get an insect that might come up your nostrils and come out your mouth fairly heavily laden. Now, that's fairly disgusting, but sometimes people swallow them. And that insect protein doesn't kill me, but it certainly doesn't make me enjoy eating. So this book is looking at what are the implications of having electric scooters, electric cars right across the planet. How is this going to destroy our grid system? What are the implications of having solar and wind to try to run industrial economies? And the end result is that all of these green policies put us into poverty. And we've spent hundreds of years getting out of poverty, and getting out of poverty, the main driver has been fossil fuels. So why should we change that? And it's a book, again, replete with facts. I have chapter after chapter after chapter with facts. I've got one chapter looking at the end of the world, and I look at all the predictions that people have made from about the 7th century AD right through the times of Paul Ehrlich and right through to the times of the IPCC. And all these people saying, we're all going to die, we're all going to fry. But by the way, you can actually stop dying and frying if you pay up. And I attack the Green Movement as if they are a new religious movement. They have their catechisms. They've got their sin. You can buy repentance. You can buy your indulgences. And they've got a holy book. And most people haven't read their holy book. And the holy book in this case are the IPCC reports, the latest of which was near on 5,000 pages long. Now, no one's going to read that, even if they suffer from sleep deprivation. So I look at this as a new religion.
Well, so and on that vein, how does academia, how does corporate world globally, how does the head of every major institution, how does almost every single prime minister, president, world leader all sing from the same hymn sheet on this? No, everyone is afraid to challenge any aspect, with few exceptions, maybe Bolsonaro, Brazil, maybe Donald Trump in the United States, Václav Klaus of Czech Republic. There's so few, you can count them on one hand, of the world leaders who are willing to challenge us. How did that happen? Do all these people really believe it, or are they intimidated into believing it?
Well, it's a case of follow the money for those in academia. If you want a successful academic career, you need to have research grants. And if you can demonstrate that a certain phenomena is driven by what is the government policy of the day, you will get funded. Now, I remember the times when I sat on the Australian, Swedish and German research councils. And in those days, if you could show that ingrown toenails drove cancer, you would get funded. Now today, if you can show that ingrown toenails are a result of climate change, you will get funded. So it's all about the money. And you will get very generous funding if you're dealing with climate change, because governments have instructed research organisations to fund climate change. Now, governments are doing that because they're frightened of the green vote, because they are trying to get the young vote. And in the case of governments, if they were losing votes from these policies, they will change very quickly. Corporations are the same. They need favour from governments. They often need subsidies. And so they follow the narrative. But if you ask someone in government, or if you ask someone in academia or someone in a corporation a really simple question, you won't get an answer. And the questions rotate around evidence. Show me the evidence. And the question I like to ask is, can you please show me that human emissions of carbon dioxide drive global warming? Now, I've asked major institutions this question. I've asked very prominent climate scientists this question. I never get an answer. I get a lot of abuse, but I never get the answer. So the whole policy on climate change it's a house of cards. No one has ever shown that human emissions of carbon dioxide drive global warming. And if you did show it, then you'd have to show that the natural emissions, which are 97% of the total, you'd have to show that they don't drive global warming. So even before you play the game, it's checkmate. So politicians are chasing votes. And the only good politician is a frightened politician. There are some politicians that haven't risen through the political system, like Mr. Trump. And so they don't follow this narrative. They get massive criticism from it. Vaclav Klaus, the former president of the Czech Republic, he was concerned about his economy, a country that has escaped from communism. And before that, it was overrun by the Nazis. That country needed to be rebuilt economically. He wasn't going to destroy his country with economic policies based on energy that were unrelated to the reality. So we see that occasionally. And so anyone who's really disheartened by this policy, keep your local politicians frightened. Keep talking to them. Don't let them off the hook. And for those in corporations, if you're a director of major companies, once the subsidies stop, you will change your view. So I think we should push our politicians to stop subsidising what is they call renewable energy. The only thing renewable about renewable energy are the subsidies. So we have to individually put pressure on every one of our politicians, and you will get a change.
All right, we have less than a minute left. How do we get out of this mess in terms, are you optimistic that we're going to find sanity in this? It just seems like the whole world is now going for the collapse ration of energy, food, transportation, our freedom of movement. How do we reverse it? You have about 40 seconds.
You mentioned the whole world. You refer to the Western world. I work a lot in third world countries as a geologist. Yes. They want to have food and they want to have their kids educated. I think the only way we'll get out of this is a recession, or perhaps a war, or perhaps both. I'm sorry, folks, that's bad news.
Wow. All right. This is Ian Plimer. Keep up your fight. Keep up the good work on this. I hope we can get a change here. The U.S. could lead the way if Donald Trump becomes president, because he has vowed to take on the whole U.N. climate narrative and pull the United States out. So he could put a huge monkey wrench into this whole thing. Thank you, Dr. Ian Plimer, climate skeptic from Australia, emeritus professor from University of Melbourne. Thank you for coming on today again.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me, Mark.
And this has been Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We'll see you next time. Thanks for watching.